please help me welcome our speaker tonight, Anthony from the Conscious Contact Group in Doylestown?
It's an honor to be here. I have to admit, you guys have a very at-risk speaker tonight. I was supposed to share in a general way what I was like, what happened, and what I'm like today. And to be quite honest, I hope to save the group and, you know, the recording of this talk, maybe I won't get into the detail of, what I'm like now, what's going on today. But I've been leveled. And, I haven't been practicing principles in all my affairs. Been driven by fear. And I've been trying my best to rely on God the most I've ever in my life. It's gotten me this far. And when I am relying on God, there is an unshakable certainty in my heart that no matter what, no one can take away my ability to transmit something from my heart to someone else for the sole purpose of recovery and the sole purpose of being a friend and to be there and to be useful and to be a part of life and contribute to it. And I'm absolutely honored to be a part of this thing. My sobriety date is September 1st, 2004. I have a sponsor who is well aware he's sponsoring me. I think that's pretty important. It's not just the honor of being able to sponsor people, you know. It's been an honor to experience life, you know. I feel, to some degree, that I'm spoiled, you know, the type of sponsorship I've had in my life and still do, and the people in my life that have taught me how to be a man and, you know, have been trying to teach me to be principled these days. It's been a hell of a ride and an awesome experience. I definitely feel a part of, which I didn't always feel, you know. Give you a little background where I come from. You know, what I was like. I'm from Philadelphia, South Philly. Most of the time, it was me and my mom and my sister. We grew up pretty poor. And I go back as far as I can remember being a pretty happy little kid, you know. I do remember that. I remember this world seeming like this place that is to explore and to get in trouble and just, you know, have fun and, you know, not a care in the world. And I realized that because I have a son, he's 6. And, I look at him and I can remember being like him, you know. And my son is so freaking damn happy. I wish my son could sponsor me, you know. Like, I just look at him running around the place and I'm like, man, I just want to be like that. No fear, no nothing, you know. He's just having a good old time, and I can remember that. But at a very early age, for me, I have started developing these ideas. And these ideas, in my head, were telling me no matter what I did in this thing called life, I'm never going to measure up. You know? And it wasn't exactly just like, you know, never feeling a part of or anything like that. Like, honestly, I wanted to stand out. You know, any type of attention is good to me, whether it's good attention or bad attention. If I'm on the subject, you know, that's good enough for me. And that's what I did, you know. I had a head that just raced so much about what people thought. And has anyone in this room ever thought someone was thinking at you? That was me, you know. I always wanted to be somewhere else. I always wanted to be somewhere else because, you know, even though I might try to stand out and all this stuff, my head comes back once again on this roundabout, like, yeah, even though so-and-so said this, they know the jig is up. They know you well enough. You're not going to make it. You're not going to measure up. you know, and then that's when I'd want to go. To the point when, you know, in elementary school, they wanted to put me in a learning disability class. You know, I just couldn't do my work. I just always was staring out the window. I was always, like, just consumed with, you know, what's the next thing that's going to happen? Never, like, what was right in front of me. And, you know, that's the only thing I thought, you know, by being a class clown, you know, that's the only way I'm going to make something of myself. You know, I have my own personal desk outside the principal's office, and, you know, I'd walk into class, and my teacher would say, "Mr. Bearden, do you feel like learning today?" And I'd be like, "Nope," and she'd just point me to my desk, and it was like, cool, I'm getting away from my peers, because they know the jig is up, you know, and then I'd be in front, you know, in front of the principal's office and seeing the older kids. I always wanted that, you know, I always wanted to be with the older guys, and, you know, because I saw, you know, alcohol and drugs were a huge part of family life for me. You know, there was always music on, there was always chaos, people coming over. You know, my dad, when he actually got back into the picture, you know, I got to see a lot of the side, like my dad's side of the family. And those guys were South Philly guys, you know, some of them were connected. Police officers that were connected with these guys. I mean, it was like some crazy stuff, you know. But they, you know, they wore pinky rings, gold watches, and chains, and suits, and they demanded fear and respect out of people in the neighborhood, you know, and they got it. And that's what I thought. That's what I aspired to. I saw those guys, and I'm like, there's no way I'm making it to school. I'm going to try to be a wise guy, you know. And, you know, they were all illegal entrepreneurs. So I decided to try my own legal entrepreneurship at a very young age, 12. I thought I had everything everyone in the neighborhood wanted, and that felt good, you know. And the whole time, still, just like, I mean, I drove myself so crazy. I was like 10 years old with ulcers in my stomach, you know, just so much fear. You know, it was, to sum it up, I would have to say it was painful being me, you know, and there was just a number of things going on. I can't say that because of my circumstances in my family make me an alcoholic, but it definitely didn't help anything, you know, like there's, you know, I couldn't get any kind of relief, you know what I mean, and the family I come from, you didn't talk about your problems, you didn't, you know what I mean, like kids were seen, not heard, like all that stuff, you know, and I understand why, you know, my parents are survivors, you know, they survived, they did whatever it took to put food on the table and a roof over my head, and they spent so much time doing that and trying to survive and keep us safe, you know, there really wasn't much time for ball games and like all that stuff, you know, and it's not their fault, but I thought that they were just like pieces of crap, and now like looking at it and seeing, you know, where my parents come from and the parents they had, I had it easier, you know. First night I experienced something, it was awesome, it was amazing. You know, I found out later on, you know, what really makes me an alcoholic. And this night, see, I had experience. I had friends and, well, not friends, but like, you know, cousins and family members that thought it was cool seeing the little kids get drunk, like on New Year's Eve and stuff. So, you know, I remember my first drink, I was like 5. It was like Seagram 7 and 7 Up on New Year's Eve. And it was just a thing to do. We were drinking out of coffee mugs and, you know, it was just fun. But alcohol didn't do the magic for me. You know, I was around 12 years old, riddled with fear. You know, we got introduced to my first house that, because we were going with, when it was me, my mom, and my sister, we would go from apartment to apartment. And I always had to share a room with my sister with bunk beds. So I get introduced to my first bedroom in this house, you know, that I had to myself. And they were like, "How do you like it?" I loved it. And it wasn't the fact that I had privacy. It was the fact that it had a window that led to a roof, that led to an alley. And one night, I get enough guts, and we go seek some adventure. It took a week I think my dad found like an ashtray or something like that in my room, and it was this big blowout fight, and I'm like, I'll show you. So, you know, I called this new kid up from school, and I really got close to this kid because most of the guys in my family learned how to box. I had a couple cousins in the Golden Gloves. Two of my uncles ran a gym in South Philly, and I was building a little reputation for myself. And I started because I was real fat as a kid. They actually used to call me Boob because I had one. I got picked on a lot. You know what I mean? So not only do I got stuff going on at home, I don't feel like, you know, I'm constantly on the run, even in my own classroom. On top of that, I got a nickname Boob, and, you know, yeah, it was rough. You know, I started getting in shape. I started learning how to box, and, you know, these kids were picking on the new kid at school, and I remember getting picked on. And at that time, I was no longer getting picked on. I was actually kind of turning into a bully, and I picked up for this kid. And the reason why I picked up for him is because I've been in that school my entire life so far, and the entire time I felt like the new kid, you know. So I picked up for this kid. We exchanged numbers, and the night that I wanted to see some adventure, I call him up. And it's funny because his mom had so many kids, she would just like kick him out of the house and just hope the guy doesn't get arrested, you know. So he's like, come on over, we'll hang out and stuff. It's 10 o'clock on a school night. I'm 12, he's 13. And, you know, I sneak out, and I'm such a rebellious person. I'm so against authority. I'm so about I'll show you that when I got over that alley wall, there was this huge weight lifted off of my shoulders. Like, I did feel a sense of freedom, you know. I was like, oh, man, I'm like, out, like one step closer to being out of one of the prisons that I created for myself. And I went down to Fifth and Moore. This guy, Crazy Ed, a Dominican guy, sold 40s of Oldie out of the back of his little corner grocery store, and put it in our school bag, and, you know, we proceeded to drink. And I got tipsy and stuff, and it was like 2 o'clock in the morning. Had to get home, like, oh man, you know. And the thing is, it still didn't do the magic for me. I didn't put two and two together yet, you know. I felt some of the effects by alcohol, but I still had that feel, like, oh my God, I got to get home and all this stuff. So, you know, I wanted to get home, and I didn't want to go through the park. There was a cop parked in the middle of this park, and I know everybody got nailed for curfew. And I looked to my right, there's all these gangster dudes, you know, like 17, maybe 20 people hanging out on this guy, Butchie Step, and, you know, they raises from 15 to 27. It's 2 o'clock in the morning on a school night, and I got to walk past these guys, and I thought they were going to kick the crap out of me, but I didn't want to walk past the cops, so I started walking towards them. They're yelling over to me, and I'm like, man, these guys are going to kick the crap out of me in front of this cop. This sucks, you know, and I walk over to them anyway, and they're like, what are you doing? And, you know, I try to play it off like, yo, you don't know me. I'm just hanging with my homie and all this stuff. You know, mind you, I got my hat to the back. Saggy pants, complete idiot, you know, and all hard and stuff. And they were like, hey, why don't you sit with us before you get killed around this neighborhood this time of night? And right then and there, I felt like I made it, you know, for about 5 minutes. I sat down there, and I'm like, these guys came on in and hang out with them. So I asked them if they like Heineken. They're like, yeah, you can't go wrong with Heineken. I said, I'll be right back. I went ran all the way down 4th Street, snuck back into the house, got into the basement, got a case of Heineken over the yard wall, alley gate, and I'm running down Momentum Avenue, 2:30 in the morning, 12 years old, with a case of Heineken for these guys, because I wanted to prove something to them. They felt like it was time for a celebration, so we packed 4 or 5 cars, went down to Franklin D. Roosevelt Park in South Philly. We called it down the lakes, and we broke into their pool. I got a 15-year-old girl on my shoulders playing chicken with these guys. I think my drinking career was off to a great start. You know? And the thing is I wanted to experience this night every night of my life. You know? Because at some point, I realized the magic that was produced by alcohol. I was no longer thinking about being accepted by those guys. You know, I wasn't thinking about my parents. I wasn't thinking about anything but just the moment that I was experiencing, and it was awesome. You know, and I realized that whether I'm sneaking out or if my dad's flying off the handle and I can't sneak out, and I don't know if he's going to kick my door and give me enough drinks and I'm sitting in the corner of my room, I'll be okay. You know? And that's what I realized. You know, that's the, you know, the effect produced by alcohol can the physical attributes is similar to mostly everyone on the planet. You know, you drink enough, you get tipsy, you continue to drink, you get drunk, you continue to drink, you get sick, hungover. All those things kind of pretty much apply to everyone similar on the planet. And but that's not why I drank, you know. Absolutely, I drank to, you know, loosen my shoulders up and stuff. But, like, I drink to get to that point where I'm no longer in concern about any problem, any person, you know, and that's what alcohol does for a guy like me. So I drink for what it does for me, not exactly what it does to me. And to the fact that what alcohol can do for me is every one of you guys can be staring me in the face. Life is kicking the crap out of me. And everyone's talking attitude and attitude. And the sound is so loud, it's deafening. I can't concentrate for 1 second. You give me enough drinks, I can drink all the fuel away like that. And that is something I consider magical. It is what I felt I had to hold on to with everything that I had. It never made sense to me to not get drunk. It never made sense to me when a friend of mine would call me up and say, "Hey, yo, me and so-and-so got a six-pack. You want to go over to the schoolyard?" And I'd be like, "What? Like, why? Like, how many six-packs? One? That doesn't even make sense, you know? I would get pissed, you know? If you give me one or two beers, like, come on. What's the point? It's just going to piss me off. We're in the hills and you got these Annies or something like that. Maybe I'll just miss the 2 beers and kick them in. You know, and that's how it was. Like, I always, whatever it was, you know, like, my whatever of choice is what you got. You know, what you got. Because I'm ready. You know, I'm always ready to just be oblivious to everything. So, second thing I felt I had to hold on to everything I had was this girlfriend I met. I was 14, she was 12. Everyone laughs when they hear that, but it was a legitimate Bonnie and Clyde, Romeo and Juliet relationship. I met her on a bus, she walked in. It's like, wow, she's really hot. And, you know, I'd go to get off the bus. I was cutting school and going to my house to continue my legal entrepreneurship while my parents were at work. And, you know, I get up and I had this black school bag with a leaf drawn on it with white out pen in my back pocket. And I hear from the back of the bus, "Yo, nice pot leaf." And I was like paralyzed. Like, I can't believe this girl just said something to me, you know? And, you know, so nothing from me could actually be attractive enough to grab this girl's attention. So I turn around and I'm like, "I got a lot of it. Do you want some?" And needless to say, our love started in a cloud of smoke. And we hit it off immediately. Loved her to death. And you know, the thing is why I felt I had to hold on to this girl, because those nights, like, my dad was a violent guy. There was a lot of violence in the house. There was a lot of craziness, you know. And then I come from a dysfunctional family and dysfunctional neighborhood, you know. And the times that I couldn't get out and I couldn't sneak out, I couldn't get away, you know, she'd be on the phone with me telling me I love you, it's going to be okay. And that meant something to me, because any love that I did receive from my family was never good enough. Why? Because they're supposed to love me. That means nothing. You know, to a guy like me, I had such expectations, you know, for people and my family, like, they're supposed to. In fact, they're not doing enough, you know. So, you know, this girl who didn't have to, you know, really cared about me. And by the time I turned 16, we were going through a lot of stuff. She was disowned from her family. I was sneaking her in my basement at night so she had a place to stay. Her parents found me out. And, like, you know, my dad and the family, you know, have a lot of stuff going on at the house. Her parents contacted detectives and said that I was of age and holding her hostage in the house. So detectives came kicking in the door. I thought they were there for something else and tried to run out the back door. They almost shot me. They found out, like, you know, that I wasn't of age. And we had a discussion and stuff. And my dad came home and he looked at me and he was like, "Dude, we can't have this coming to the house. You know what's going on here." And I was like, "Okay, well then, you know, whatever." And they had to sit down with me and they said, you know, I'm telling this story the best of my knowledge and the best way that I can be honest. But I know my perception has been off for a long time, you know, but I'm trying my best. But, and how I know this is because some things trigger things later on that I realized, man, that wasn't the truth, you know. And what I heard from my parents that day, you know, what they really did tell me was that we love you, we'll do anything we can for you. We know we don't have much, but we'll try. You got to go back to school. You got to stop this drug thing, and that girl has to go. What I heard was, It's either her or us. That's what I heard for a long time. So I packed my bag. I'm 16 years old. She's 15. I'm a man. I can take care of her. And I'll show you. So I walk outside. She was hanging out in the corner. I walk up to her and I'm like, okay, so where are we going? We went to her friend's house. And this was in 1997. And that house, the address was 1939 East Somerset Street. Between Frankfurt and Emerald in Somerset in 97. It was off the hook in that neighborhood. And then we stayed one night there. And she said, you can't stay here, but you can stay with my family, her grandparents. And it was a non-English-speaking family. It was 2912 D Street in between Cambridge and Indiana. And, man, 16 years old, thinking, you know, I got this reputation in South Philly, and, you know, I can handle this. And, man, it was on. And, you know, I went to Kensington for one night. I stuck for 6 years, you know. I love Kensington. It is a neighborhood that I moved to in 97 that made me feel comfortable being obliterated under any and all substances 24/7. And what made it comfortable for me, everyone and their mom, literally their mom, was into it too. You know, I didn't have to sweep anything under the rug anymore. And by the time I turned 18, I was in some serious trouble. You know, I got some serious charges. It was in 1999 when they passed the law, 3 strikes you're out for violent crimes, 25 to life. I was 18 years old, and 2 weeks after my 18-year-old birthday, I'm sitting in front of a public pretender. He's telling me, listen, I know you got these 3 charges, you know, first degree, and you don't have to worry about this whole 25 to life thing, man. Like, it's, you know, it's your first time around, we can get you a deal. And I'm like, so what's that deal? And he's like, 15 to 30, you know? And the gangster I am, I immediately started crying, and I called my mom. haven't seen or talked to him in 2.5 years, and I called him and said, I'm in a lot of trouble, I need help. So they got an attorney, and I talked to him. They're like, we can put this in, like, drug court and all this stuff, you know, but you have to go to treatment today. So that was my first treatment experience. I was in Eagleville Hospital, and my first night, it was a meeting, it was a different fellowship. This guy, you know, had all the silver chains on and a throwback and a hat to the side and was screaming at everyone. I'm sitting in there, I'm like, what the heck is going on? And he's pointing people out in the audience that have been there 3 or 4 times already. And I'm completely disassociating myself with everyone. I'm like, man, I'm here because I'm seriously trying to get the heat off of my back. You know what I mean? And like, I'm not coming back to the, like, damn, all these strangers and these people are crazy. Well, I ended up resigning at Eagleville Hospital 4 more times after that stay, by the way. They only had 1 bed left in the entire facility. I ended up being in the SAID program, which is on Levy 2. This was in 1999 in September. And it was the SAID program from all the guys from the penitentiary. You know, so it was the transitional part before they go to a 3-quarter house or halfway house or whatever. So I'm on a, it's like a cell block almost, like rehab turned into a cell block, and I'm 18 years old, don't know anything about recovery. I'm trying to save my life. I don't want to hurt anymore, but it was a joke. It was a joke. You know, I didn't have a shot here. with all that hanging over my head, I leave AMA 2 months in. Because a guy like me, I can't hang in there. You know? My threshold for pain in sobriety is nil. It is like this. You give me some stuff, bring it on. Just give me that. I'll be on the street. You can break my ribs. You can take me hostage. You can do whatever. I'm good. Fine. Give me that. I'll handle it. Rehab, stone cold sober. And I'm left with myself and my thoughts and recreating the wreckage and the damage and all this just, I mean, it's like agony. I don't know how anyone in this room has conducted themselves while they're out there drinking and carrying on. But I hated myself for what I became. You know, absolutely hated myself. So how can I be in rehab and sitting in my bed after all day getting grouped to death and people telling me that it's going to be okay, wait for the miracle to happen, and like all this stuff, and I got to lay my head down the pillow and I can't sleep? How's it going to be okay? Not for a guy like me. I can't bear it, you know? And I can't wait for that moment to happen. You know, I can't wait to get out of rehab to find these people they're talking about. How do I find them? I was speaking at an anniversary meeting last night, and it was about sponsorship. It was my topic. I had a small amount of time to talk about it. Those guys people say stay away from, go run to them. More than likely, they're the guys that are in the center of AA, and they're spending their pretty much entire life trying to save other people's lives. You know? Because when we look at ourselves, we just almost killed ourselves. That's the best we can do. How can we really pick out a winner? When they say, go stick with the winners. Like, how the hell do I know to pick that person? So that's why it was always encouraging me, Anthony, you have experience with these steps. You go find everyone you can that's willing to listen to you for 5 minutes. Thank God I had a sponsor like that, because that's what he did for me. Because a gangster like me, crippled with fear, I'm not asking another man for help. Even if I like the pendulum. Because I don't know what kind of help it is. I don't know what's going to happen. I don't know what is going to be transmitted to me. I'm coming to meetings hoping to God something rubs off on me. And it never does. You know? So I left Eagleville Hospital 2 weeks in. And my brother, who got out of prison. He was in prison for a long time. He was trying to help his little brother, you know. And he got me into Eagleville Hospital, in fact. And I lied to him. I told him, dude, my insurance ran out. I've never been in treatment in my life. Like, I probably could have been there a year, you know. And already I knew how to manipulate. Isn't that crazy? Like, I just, you know. So I told him that, and we got into a lot of trouble. And he got me into this halfway house called Fresh Start, Frankfurt and Tioga. This is in 1999. And there was some crazy shit happening at that halfway house, recovery house, if you want to call it that. But, I was there detoxing out of my mind for like 6 days. I think I made it 6 days. I don't know. Very foggy. Try my best to be honest. I wanted to leave. You know, this guy cursed me out. He was managing the house and said I should effing look like I want to effing be here or whatever. And I'm 18 years old. I got some money in the safe. And all of a sudden I had to do like 10 loads of laundry. I left. I got a cab from Frankfurt and Tioga to 5th and Westmoreland, and I ended up like 20 minutes after that cab ride at 5th and Allegheny, sitting on the pavement with tears in my eyes. How did this happen again? You know? How? So I go back to the recovery house. Oh my God, what a slug that must have been. I go back to the recovery house, and I look at one of the like younger managers, and I'm like, hey, and he goes, oh my God, dude, what the heck is wrong with you? I'm like, what? And I was like, do I look stoned or something? He's like, you are a trigger to everyone in this house. And I'm like, what's a trigger? You know? And I'm like, Jesus, I'm getting, you know, outcast again. So they go on and discuss with me. They said, you gotta go. You're not serious about this. And I'm like, please, for the love of God, I'm like, I want this so bad. I just don't know what to do. I'm hurting. And they're like, we can't help you. And I'm like, there's gotta be something you can do. They're like, you just left the treatment center AMA. They're not gonna take you back. And I'm like, well, what can I do? And they were like, okay, we got an option for you. Friends Hospital. If you go there and act crazy, and say you're going to hurt yourself or someone else. They'll let you in. And then you tell them, like, you know, you got a serious addiction problem. And I'm like, okay. So they put me in the car. They drive me over to this place. And I walk in, and I'm like, all right, act crazy, right? And they're like, yeah. So I walk in, like, twitching and shaking and stuff, you know? Oh, my God. And I'm, like, trying to play this Oscar role, you know? And there's this doctor with this clipboard in front of me, and he's just nodding. I'll never forget, you know, he was just looking down, nodding his head. And he probably was saying, kid, listen, man, we'll let you in, but just stop twitching and shaking. It's going to be okay, you know? And then that was during the whole bipolar epidemic in 1999. They sit me in front of a bunch of doctors, and I'm sitting there, and they say, Anthony, do you get depressed? And I'm like, look at me, are you kidding me? Of course, my life is like shit right now, of course. And they're like, well, do you get really like excited and exert yourself and happy and want to help people even? And I'm like, yeah, like when I get my stuff and I'm loaded, sure. And they're like, yeah, and they're like, you got it. And I'm like, what? And they're like, did you ever hear of bipolar disorder? And I'm like, no. And they're like, well, there's different... there's different elements, I guess you can say, you know, bipolar disorder, and one of them happens to be what we think you suffer from, which is manic depression. And I, like, put my head in my hands, and I'm like, oh, my God, it was bittersweet. You know I'm screwed for the rest of my life. That's the bitter part. But the sweet part is, like, man, finally they have a label, and they know what the heck is wrong with me, you know, and I'm screwed for the rest of my life. And they say, but it's going to be okay. And I'm like... how is it going to be okay? And they're like, we have medication. And this light bulb goes off. And I'm like, wow, thanks. Like, I was actually just going to ask you guys for some medication. You can't be going to walk around unless I'm not medicated. You know? So I get voted most likely to succeed out of the psych ward. President of the psychosis groups. They go to buzz me out of those electronic doors. And once again, that, you know, the butterflies in the stomach. And those butterflies, that tension, is not about a craving. It's not about drugs and alcohol being some kind of trigger, and I'm afraid of that. I'm afraid of life. I don't know how to live. You know, it has nothing to do with that. I'm completely sober. I've been detoxed. I've been, you know, president of a group. It has nothing to do with that. It's like, how do I live? You know? So what happens? You know, I go right back out. Back and forth, back and forth. And, you know, I've experienced some insane stuff. You know, by the time my girlfriend, she was 21, and we were walking down the street one day, doing our thing, Kensington, hanging in there, and she stops. She had to sit on a step, and I'm like, what's going on? What's wrong? And she couldn't breathe. And I would do anything for this girl. Anything. I mean... it was, that always remained, you know, me and you against the world until we died. That was it. We had to go to the hospital, and she gets checked out, EKGs and all this stuff, and come to find out she has endocarditis. Endocarditis is a blood infection. What happens is the blood gets in your, I mean, a microscopic piece of it. Bacteria, it gets in your blood and it goes through your bloodstream, and then when it gets to your heart, it stays and it starts to vegetate. You know, it grows, and you can treat it. You know, you know, she had it pretty bad, and when they discovered it, it passed through her heart into her lungs, and. You know, I stayed by her side at the hospital bed. This was at Kensington Hospital, and then they transferred her to UPenn. And, I detoxed right next to her. I stayed with her for 2.5 months. And I promised, we'll get married, we'll do everything all over again. Like, just please get out of here. Like, I'm sober now, and we can do this, you know. They asked me for her parents' info after they disowned her 6 years, not in her life, because things were, you know, not getting too much better. And her mom came to that hospital, and she had me removed by the police, you know. And, man, I called my friend to go visit her, check up on her, see how she's doing. And 2 days later, he gives me a call, and he says, "I'm really sorry, but Jill is dead." And I said, "What happened?" And he said, "Well, the doctors want to introduce a new, extremely powerful antibiotic to fight it. She's 21 years old." And her mom said, "No, pull the plug." Talk about having a resentment. Destroyed. You know, the one thing that made sense to me to be on this planet was gone. You know? So if anyone came to me with the idea or you could be sober and happy at the same time, I would punch them in the face. I just wanted to die. You know, I just wanted to get out. God, if you exist, please take me off this planet. It isn't about being dealt a bad hand or anything like that. I don't care about any of the circumstances. I want out. You know? And I tried to take myself out. I was found 4 times in 1 weekend. The last time I was found, it was in the back of the cemetery. I think I have some kind of purpose here. You know, the paramedics found me. It was the same 2 paramedics that found me the day before. And they 302'd me. They're like, "You're trying to kill yourself." I'm like, "No, I'm just, you know, messed up." And they're like, "No, we're taking you with us." And so they did. And, I ended up at the last stop. This was August 31st, 2004. And my sobriety date is September 1st, 2004. And the reason why I ended up at the last stop is because I ended up in another rehab or detox, and I met this female. And, you know, it's a crazy story that I really can't get into. It's pretty funny, but, you know, we... just put it this way, you know, I knew this girl for 2 weeks through detox and rehab, and love can no longer be bound by the CAs and the techs at St. Joe's detox in Girard and 16th Street in Philadelphia. So we're on the streets by that point, and I'm looking at her, and I've just been completely destroyed by the relationship that I've, you know, had prior to this, and everything you could think of that goes on out there. And I see this girl, she's 19 years old, I'm 23. And I know the next step and what's going to happen to this girl. I just didn't want that to happen. So we were outside the St. Francis Inn Mission. And I pointed across the street to people that could help her. And she's like, "I want to go there." And I'm like, "Well, I'll go with you. How about that?" And my head told me that I can detox again. I've done it so many times. But like, hopefully she can meet some women and do this thing. I don't have any hope. I just hopefully I can see that happen. As soon as that happens, I'm out the door. What happened? I walk in there with her. We're under the influence, and we see Eddie Z. And Eddie Z looks at us, and he's like, "Yo, dog, this ain't no honeymoon suite." You know? I'm like, "Please, Ed, like, we need help here." And he's like, "She can stay. You gotta go." And I was like, "Can I stay for the meeting?" And he's like, "All right." So, you know, the meeting happened. He's walking out the door. I'm trying to be like a fly on the wall. And he turns around, and he looks at me, and I'm like, "So if you want to stay sober, there's a spot on the floor over there under the television." And I said, "Thanks." And that night, a guy tried to explain to me what a hole in the soul was. Never heard that before. I didn't know everything exactly what this man was saying to me. I was still under the influence. But what I did remember is that he spent till like 4 or 5 in the morning trying to explain to me what alcoholism was. You know, and the next day I heard the same thing. And by the third day, I'm like, "Man, maybe me and this girl can fight this thing together." You know, and found out she, like, you know, because we were separated, I had to stay at the clubhouse. She went to G&E with like all the guys and girls and stuff, and she slept with some other dude while she was there. I was convinced I'm cursed, and God has cursed me, and I'm done. I'm out of here. You know, and I'm walking out. Of the last stop, I just want a cigarette and I'm out. And this guy Ante comes to me and he's like, "Dude, you need to get in the car." And I'm like, "Dude, I need a Newport and I'm out of here." And he's like, please, let's just go in the car. And I told him, nah, I'm not, you know. So this is what happened. I ended up going into the car. He bribed me with some cigarettes. And, you know, this is after he told me you're going to Harbor City, Baltimore, Maryland for a meeting. I'm like, yes, why? There's two more meetings here tonight at the clubhouse. Why try that far, you know? And he's like, please, for the love of God. He's like arguing with me. So I get in the car. I get stuck in the back of this Mustang in the bucket seats. Like, two guys. You know, I'm 3 days into this thing, detox. And I'm like, just obnoxious as hell, like, God bless these guys. So we head on 95 South, and I asked the driver for a light, and he looks at me, he's like, there's no smoking in this car. I'm like, so they go to put a CD in. I'm like, all right, maybe they got some cool music, you know. I'm like, so who's that? They're like, Tom Flynn. I'm like, who's Tom Flynn, a country singer? They're like, no, it's the speaker we're going to hear tonight. And I'm like, wait a second. You're telling me, we're driving 2.5 hours to hear a speaker that you have one CD in your car right now. Yeah. And I'm like, you're a bunch of freaks, you know? I was like, out of your mind. 2.5 hours later, I wake up to what I considered my negative Alcoholics Anonymous for a long time. Tom Flynn was speaking that night. He was sharing 24 years of sobriety. And he said something to me that hit me and changed my life forever. You know, I hear people, you know something? Screw anyone that has an opinion on anything. Get your own experience. Get your own experience. Follow your heart. Because a lot of people have opinions, and I do myself, and you may hear a couple tonight. And I apologize, but I'm opinionated. But people say that it's not what you do in between the preamble and the Our Father. It's what you do in between the Our Father and the preamble. But let me tell you something. Words are very powerful. Sometimes God speaks through us at all different times. God spoke through that man that night. It changed my life forever. So it can be what it said up here. You know? And what that man said that changed my life is he said it should be easy to surrender when there's nothing left to defend. I had nothing. He said that there was a victory over alcoholism in late 1934, when one alcoholic sat down to share his experience with another alcoholic for the sole purpose of recovery. He said the miracle happened in 1939 when these experiences were written down and shared with the world in a published book called Alcoholics Anonymous. The war is over. Just stay 3 feet behind us. Relief. And what I got to see was Alcoholics Anonymous in action again. I got into the smoker's car. It was Ante and this guy, Scott Stevenson. And they don't know this, but I was in the backseat of that car with tears in my eyes, wishing and hoping I could experience the happiness those guys were feeling that night. They were talking about going to another state to hear another speaker. They were talking about sponsoring guys. They got to go here and there to fist steps and, you know, bring a meeting into a hospital for a sick friend. Like, and the joy and the excitement that they had, because I realized that night, like, this is a movement, you know. This is one hell of a deal to be a part of. And those guys were asking me if I was willing to be a part of it, because I had a seat right in their car. And I felt like I was home. All my life I've been wanting to find some kind of purpose. My life is meaningless. It means nothing. I want to be out. And these guys are telling me, Anthony, you have so much to offer. You have no idea. You have millions of friends to meet that are just waiting for you. And I believe them, because they were experiencing this. And I was willing to do whatever they were doing just to feel what they were feeling, you know? So, and that was my experience. I got free. I went through the steps. I did that fourth step. You know the funny thing about the third step? As I already told you guys, God, if you exist, please take me off this planet. Why should it be so hard for me to turn my will and my life over to the care of whatever, whether I understand it or not? Why should it be so hard when I already gave my life up for nothing? Please take it. And it once my life was not taken. So what does that mean to me? This is no longer my life to live. I am no longer an owner of what is going to happen to me. I was put here for a reason. That's for my brothers and sisters. Period. Because if it was up to me, I wouldn't be here. You know? Selfish, self-centered to the core. And that's still to this day. Without those guys, without good guidance, without God in my life, without someone to help, I'm the same selfish, to the core, self-centered, fearful little kid. See, these ideas of God, when I brought to Alcoholics Anonymous any objections to God or anything like that, you know why? It's because when I started really getting into my alcoholism and active in it, I was very young. And that shut any idea or any growth of God that I had or could experience. So basically, I brought a 12-year-old's perception and conception of God to Alcoholics Anonymous. All of those ideas had to be eliminated. You know? So I took my sponsor's experience, and I did that 4-step, and that girl's mom was on it. And I said, this is justifiable, bro. How can you tell me, like, that girl was innocent? And he said, you know what, you have every right to be angry. And you can hold on to this, you can keep this, you know? I can't argue with this. But what I can guarantee you is that you will never be free if you do hold on to this. If you want to be sober and you want to ride with us and you want to be effective in helping, you know, the guys before you, I'd seriously consider finding a way. I don't know exactly how you have to do it, Anthony, but you gotta get right with God and you gotta let this go. And somehow, some way, it was gone. But I was active, I was helping the guys, and it saved my life, you know. And it was just an amazing experience at the last time. Running around the East Coast, you know, Jack was a part of it. I mean, like, you know, we were riders for a while, like, inseparable. Just, like, moving and shaking and trying to help anyone that's willing to listen to us for 5 minutes, you know. And it was a blast. And thank God for all those experiences because it has kept me alive so far through some leveling freaking times in my life, which is going on right now. And that's why, you know, I say I am not perfect. I am without God at my best, I'm dangerous. You know, I can bring destruction in relationships and my family. You know, it's very possible. You know, for a guy like me, when I don't get what I want, you know, it's, you know, and so the whole surprise here is January 13th, I got news that, you know, my wife is divorcing me. 6-year-old boy, you know, very good life together. Doesn't make sense. 11.5 years sober. What the, you know, makes sense to her. I don't know. But I got 11. And thank God for AA. Thank God, you know. Because I'm not perfect. I'm still shook from this whole situation. But like I said, when I get to be a part of AA, whether it's up here, whether it's one-on-one, whether it's fellowship, whatever, you know, I get to feel a part of. And, you know, at the end of the night, I can say I have that certainty in my heart that I'm here for a reason. You know, I'm not a perfect guy. But I'm absolutely willing to do anything for anyone that is suffering this condition. You know, some people say it's a disease. I believe it's a gift. You know? Some people, like normal people that are going through turmoil and stuff, don't have a type of program like this and a program of action to turn to get relief. And to get hope in your heart because you see the hope come alive in someone else's eyes. You know, it's a gift. What are we going to do with it? You know? So I strongly suggest, you know, anyone that's in this room. You're not experiencing that. You're not experiencing that burden. You know, you're caught up. You've got that spring that's tied up in your stomach. You don't know what the next day is going to bring. Please grab someone that you see that's doing this deal. Especially if someone's saying, stay away from this guy or this girl. Run to him. Run. You know, I've had plenty of experience being in the center of AA consistently for years. You know, and I've heard all kinds of stuff about me. You know, but when it comes down to it, you call me 2:00 in the morning and you're in trouble, I'll be there. You know, or I will have someone there. Because I was that guy. You never know when that window of opportunity is to be effective. You know? So, please, if you're not feeling this thing, it's available. If I can feel it, like, throughout what's been going on today, it's remarkable. And it's real. I wouldn't be up here. I'm being as honest as I possibly can with everything and what's going on in my character to this day. I wouldn't lie to you about that, you know? Wow, what a note I'm leaving this one on. if anything I can say to sum everything up is, I feel I experienced an emptiness that no matter how many times I get up here to try to explain, I'll never be able to explain. But because of great sponsorship and the 12 sets of AA, and you guys, oh man, I've experienced a fulfillment in my heart that no matter how many times I get up here, I'll never be able to explain. It is experiential. You got to experience it. And there's people in this room that's willing to give it as well. And so I really appreciate everyone's time, and that's all I have to share. Thank you very much.